Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning, welcome to our new series, Where Are We Now? Our purpose is to examine some of our most urgent concerns: climate change, international conflict, gender, race, and inequality, and the state of the Earth's resources as we enter this period of transition. Our guest this morning is Professor Susanna Hecht. Professor Hecht is a professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at the University of California in Los Angeles, and also at the Graduate Institute for International Development in Geneva, in Switzerland. So first, a little more in terms of introduction. We have a long CV again this morning, but here's a taste. Professor Hecht is the author of many books, including The Social Lives of Forests, The Scramble for the Amazon, The Fate of the Forest, Developers, Destroyers, and Defenders of the Amazon, that latter with the late Alexander Coburn. Her research focuses on the intersections of economies, cultures, and land use, and the social environmental effects of these processes, an approach which is now widely known as political ecology. Her area is Latin American tropics, and more specifically Amazonia. Her research has implications for understanding the dynamics of land use change and what they imply about human relations with nature, economies, and tropical development. Her work includes analytics on climate change, mitigation, and longer-term rethinking about strategies under globalization, intense migration, and novel climate dynamics. She is a member of Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, and as I mentioned earlier, she also holds an appointment at the Graduate Institute for Developmental Studies in Geneva. Good morning, Professor Hecht, and welcome back.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here again. And I also think about California and stuff, too, you know.
Okay,
I mean, and I think about Central America as well. I'm not just an arcane Amazonianist, but so I'll be talking a little bit about lots of these things, particularly since I don't know what your weather was like, but we basically had a hurricane a couple of weeks ago here.
No, I didn't know that. Well,
yeah,
we're just
70-mile-an-hour winds and, you know, an inch an hour. So, how are you liking your climate change?
Sort of floating out to sea.
I see. Yeah, you guys got tons of water.
And lots of snow in the mountains.
Okay.
And can I call you Susanna?
Of course you can.
Sure. Okay, so maybe some basics then, since you just mentioned, you sort of gave us a little trip around the forests of the world. Tell us a little bit about your interest in forests and what you mean by forests, and then maybe you could say a word about, in general, what you do as a student of this.
Well, first of all, I sort of got involved in this for reasons that anyone might, which is that you get concerned about the environment. You're a young person, and you think, I'll go and save the world. And, of course, why not? You know, you have to start somewhere. And, of course, anyone with any ambition will sort of think that you personally by yourself can handle, you know, it's just that people haven't thought correctly about these things. So this is the arrogance and innocence of youth, which, of course, led me eventually to the Amazon, thinking that if they could just understand the ecology of what was happening when you took down forests, why everyone would stop doing it immediately and think about forest-based development. Well, in fact, of course, there was a lot to learn between my ecology classes and actual Amazonian development.
So give us the steps. How do you go from an ecology class to what you eventually began to do?
Well, part of it was actually taking, even though getting scientific training, I went to the University of Chicago, and they make you take these world civilization classes. So you can't sort of say, well, I'm a scientist, so I don't have to know this. So I was going from my ecology classes, which were on Central America and South America, and then my following class was a class on Latin American history. And so they were talking about the same places the scientists were talking about, but they were talking about it as though it had no biology, and the scientists were talking about it as though it had no human history. So, again, when I say this, I just kind of blush, but I thought, well, oh, that'll be simple. I'll just put these two things together. Well, it's in fact, that's what my career has involved, is looking at forest environments and how they're created out of human history and human actions. So this wasn't entirely a futile thing. It's just the magnitude of the task was not clear to me when I began. But that's sort of the story of life in general, I think, which is that there's so much more that you realize when you first start out. But if you knew, you'd never do it. So there's that as well. So when we were talking before, you wanted me to say a few things about what's going on with global forests.
Sure, that would be great.
And one of the things that's interesting is that, there's good news and there's bad news, I suppose. So let me just sort of lay out a few things, and then maybe I could talk also a little bit about sort of the new political changes and what those might mean for forest dynamics. First of all, surprisingly, tropical forests, at least in Amazonia, have had a major decline in deforestation. So
A decline, yes.
Yeah. You're not used to hearing this, I'm sure. But since 2004, deforestation rates in Amazonia have dropped by close to 80%. So this doesn't mean that there's no deforestation, because the deforestation rate was really high in 2004. But if you had asked me to take a bet in 2004 that a little more than a decade later you'd be this low in the terms of deforestation rates, and that pattern is sort of somewhat generalized throughout Amazonia. If you look at some of the numbers from other places, again, this doesn't mean that there's no deforestation. It's that the aggregate deforestation has slowed. So the big question is, why has that happened? Well, one thing is that they've sort of put some brakes and intensification on the deforestation associated with soybean expansion.
And who's they?
A complicated alliance of social movements, of national supply chains and international supply chains, boycotts on Amazonian beef, boycotts on Amazonian soy, a lot of social movements blocking the expansion of land speculation, a much better capacity to monitor land use change through satellite imagery, better enforcement of existing laws, so the state had a role in this, and also, enforcement of existing laws. So there's a lot of different things that go on at a lot of different levels, from the ground level and groundswell against deforestation to large-scale international boycotts. So one of the things that's really interesting about this dynamic is that it is multi-level and also goes on at multiple scales. But let me also say that while deforestation has slowed in this really iconic and important landscape, it's kind of exploded elsewhere. So if you look at the sort of dry Chaco of Argentina, that area is got a lot of soy expansion. If you look at parts of Bolivia, and some of your readers or listeners might have seen in the New York Times the Bolivian expansion of soybean, which I worked on in the 1990s, to give you an example of how long that stuff has been going on. The Brazilian Cerrado, which is like a Brazilian savanna, that area has also been having really high rates of deforestation. And Paraguay also. So what you have is a little bit of what's called leakage in the technical sense, which is that you control it one place, but it's like when you stomp on a puddle, you have the stuff under your foot that's under control, but it's bouncing out everywhere. And Latin America now is the major global food supplier of soy.
Why soy? What's that about?
Only about 6% of global soy is eaten by people. So you might think, well, what's wrong with that? You know, why is soy such a villain here? We're always told that it's like so great, but only 6% of global supply is eaten, and that means that of the 7 billion people on the earth, very few of them are eating soy, and most of them are in Asia, of course. Who's really eating soy is animals. And also soy is a biofuel source as well. But the main thing that's driving it is the intermarket for meat, and particularly in the rising economies of China and India. So this is a globalization story. And it's also a story about the sort of transformation of the United States from being a global leader in soy into being not exactly second fiddle, but as a region, its importance for soy production is considerable, but it's now been exceeded by Latin American soybean production. And again, that's largely for export and for animal production. So you need to sort of think about this sort of meatification, as it's called sometimes, of the Asian diets as a function of increasing wealth, and also a shift from sort of peasant production of pigs and chickens and so on within a peasant household into this agro-industrial slaughterhouse model that we have perfected, I would say.
And fast food, is that an aspect of it?
What?
Fast food, is that an aspect of it?
Yes. Well, soy as food mostly goes to animals.
Yeah.
Okay, that's, again, 6% of...
So McDonald's, hamburgers?
It goes more into pigs and chicken because the main... But it goes also into beef as well.
Okay.
But there's a lot of, and it's not that production of beef is minor, but globally the production in terms of billions of animals and kilos of protein is more pigs and chicken exceed the beef.
Okay.
We eat a lot of beef, but people elsewhere don't eat so much of it.
Okay, so to grow it, forests need to be cleared?
Mm-hmm. They don't need to be cleared, but that's what's happened. That's where it's expanded. Part of it is a function of technical change. Soils are pretty acid, and so the microorganism that fixes nitrogen for soil to be selected for. So they did a lot of selection on the soy, and most of the soy, by the way, is GMO. It's Roundup Ready, so it's Monsanto soy for the most part. But what Monsanto and other seed companies did is they snagged the public research that had been done in Brazil that had adapted microorganisms for these tropical soils and also soybeans for what's called day-length neutrality. Most soy is grown in temperate zones, and they have a longer day length, right, in the summer. So they couldn't really grow in the tropics, so they had to select for some that could handle the fact that, you know, you sort of have 12 hours of light and 12 hours of dark in the tropics. So there was a bunch of adaptation that had to go on. It was largely carried out in the public institutions in Brazil, a little bit in Argentina, and then it those patents were bought out, and so now those are largely owned by the by Monsanto and other large international seed corporations and integrated into the Roundup Ready genome that they use for the tropics. So before, it wasn't that you couldn't, it was you didn't have the organism that could actually occupy the tropics, the soybean that could occupy the tropics. And so that's why you had sort of through a lot of the late 20th century, a lot of failures in agricultural development because the adaptation stuff didn't work very well. But there had been a consistent attention to soybean in Brazil since, you know, since the 1970s as a means of occupying the Cerrado areas and so on, the Brazilian savannas. And then that frontier just pushed into Amazonia. So that was one of the things that was critical in the deforestation. The other is the continuing dynamic of livestock. And that, again, is for international markets as well as national markets. So if you look at land use in Latin America, the largest area is always in cattle. But that cattle is kind of like a placeholder. It's part of a land grabbing. It's part of waiting until you can intensify. It's a means of speculating on land. It's got a lot of dimensions to it that go beyond simply the production of protein. And it's not a very efficient producer of protein anyway. But so in any case, Brazil is now the world's largest beef exporter too. You have a lot of these integrated things where you finish cattle with corn and soybeans and then export it. So it's gone from being sort of seen as kind of a third world production area, mainly in what are called traditional crops like coffee and sugar, into global, what we might call temperate zone commodity crops of soybean and beef. So the largest beef marketeer and beef producing and the largest abattoirs, JRB, is now are Brazilian companies. So there's been a real big structural shift in agriculture, which has been reflected in both a shift from sort of more, how shall we say, peasant-based or more traditional forms of land use and land use management into highly corporatized and highly managed systems. And remember that Latin America has been had an export development model forever. So this is just shifting new commodities into these circuits.
So,
and the markets are different. The markets are Asian.
Okay. So
Asian and Middle Eastern.
So I'm sitting here thinking we're talking about forests, but we're not. You haven't mentioned trees or wood.
Transformation of forests, yeah. Which is the story.
Right.
You know?
Are the trees just something that get in the way?
No, they aren't something that gets in the way. They are also produced by different kinds of political ecologies. So I've been talking about forests being lost, but
yeah.
I'll tell you there's another dynamic that's going on, which is a lot of forest recovery.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's sort of surprising when you think about the fact that so much of Latin America has been deforested, and then so you have some control of forest deforestation in particularly iconic landscapes, these humid tropical landscapes. You also have forest recovery. Now, part of that reflects migration, that is, people moving out of forested areas into cities. Some of it reflects environmental constraints that, you know, crappy areas just don't support agriculture. And there's also a policy thing, which is food prices that the prices that small farmers get for agricultural commodities is relatively low. So people have migrated, they have stopped producing them. There's been a contraction in agriculture, and so that means that forests come back. A lot of agricultural commodities are tree-based, so the continuing demand for coffee and the continuing demand for cacao, things like cashews are much more widely grown than they used to be. And then you have these other kinds of crops that come in, like mangoes, like acai, you know, the little fruit that now is everybody's favorite superfood. So those are kind of niche crops that are expanding and consolidating in these areas, too. So it's not just secondary vegetation that's coming back. It's these complex agroforestries or forest gardens that also are coming back in. Another thing is that, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s, and also in Colombia until really just recently, you had a lot of civil war going on, and that really affected the agricultural frontier, that is, people just couldn't be in these areas because they would be hammered by carpet bombing and what have you. So there was an agricultural retraction associated with that. But the other thing that happened is a lot of people migrated to the United States. The classic story, of course, is that of El Salvador, where about a sixth of the population migrated to the U.S., and particularly to California. And what you had going on there was that basically people got jobs here and so on and sent back money to their relatives in El Salvador. Now, there's lots of places where this went on, by the way. So Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Ecuador, these are places that, Colombia. So these are places where what you had was a dynamic where the prices for food commodities was really low, so it didn't make sense to grow them. And you also had households coming in and receiving remittances. So that meant that you could buy food instead of having to grow it, or at least the basic grain. So what that signified,
Still there?
What that meant is that, again, agricultural pressure on these lands shifted, and they shifted into either forest crops, which are more flexible in terms of their land dynamic, in terms of their labor dynamics, or they were let go into other kinds of forest systems. So there's what you can see in a lot of Amazonia and throughout South America is you have these double dynamics. You have expansion of certain kinds of commodities, but in peasant landscapes, what you see is a lot of forest recovery due to changes in the agrarian economy, but also due to migration, urban migration and international migration. So forests reflect a lot of complex things. So when you say you haven't said a thing about forests, I can't talk about forests just as themselves. You have to talk about them now as being sort of co-produced or reflecting regional political economies in complex ways.
Susanna, I need to pause here.
Your listeners probably need a drink by now.
No, I don't think so. Our listeners are enjoying something very fascinating. I think we're interested in these subjects up here, and we couldn't ask for anything better. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program this morning is Where Are We Now? And our guest is Professor Susanna Hecht, Professor in the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA and also at the Graduate Institute of International Development in Geneva. So, Susanna, I think I'm guilty of what you talk about in one of your first books, and that is myths and visions about Amazonia, because, you know, what I just asked you was, what about the trees? And maybe you should tell us about these problems of myths and visions and,
sure,
and understanding.
Well, one of the things, the other thing I think, besides having me as a coastal person living in Geneva and Los Angeles, is I used to live in southern Humboldt County. So I have worked a lot in southern Humboldt. So I even had a tree farm in southern Humboldt with apples, not the other local crop. Well, that's an interesting, that has some interesting parallels too. But anyway, because of course there's the coca trade and the marijuana trade, which basically kept small farmers going in these rough and difficult times, and also produced a lot of forest recovery in Northern California,
okay,
as well as in other areas. But you wanted me to talk about forest myths. Well, I think what we have is what people call the John Muir ideology, which is that forests were always, there were wild forests that were sort of at the ends of the earth and the beginnings of time. You know, that they really only reflected biotic evolution. They only reflected some kind of wild nature that had always been distant from human intervention. Now, as your audience probably knows, Yosemite was active, what had been occupied by the Miwok Indians, had been intensively managed by them. And so it's important to realize that what we take the iconic national park, the iconic wilderness, actually had a huge imprint of indigenous management, as did all of California, actually. There's a wonderful book called Managing the Wild by an ethnobiologist called Kat Anderson.
All right.
It's a wonderful book. I bet your libraries have it. And it really documents all the different ways that indigenous management occurred. And the population in California was pretty high, and the population in Latin America was extremely high. Even in Amazonia, which everybody thought was an empty area, it's important to remember that when the conquistadors came and began to sort of do stuff, they also brought in a lot of diseases to which the local populations had no resistance. So you could sort of imagine the equivalent of a kind of Ebola thing, which wiped out 95% of Ebola. It was, of course, measles and influenza and tuberculosis and things like that. But, you know, the impact on the population would be as if you had something that pretty much killed everybody who came into contact with it. So populations dropped by 95%, coming up a little bit again later in the 18th and 19th century. But the big point here is that this idea of the empty probably has a little bit of basis in reality, if you didn't want to have any history to it, which is that when a lot of people came into lots of the areas of the tropics, they sort of didn't see people, and they didn't really know how to read the landscape either. They couldn't tell what was, you know, anthropogenic and successional, that is to say, stuff that had been managed by people or were part of sort of the process of landscape recovery. And so they thought it was just empty. And that certainly is true of many people coming through. And also it was convenient to pretend that it was empty. So if you said, well, you know, nobody's growing, you know, patches of wheat here, so that must not count. It made it easier in terms of law at the time to land grab. So, of course, there are the history of Euro occupation here is the history of land grabs in a lot of ways. So one of the things is this problem of the idea of the empty and the wild as being a sort of configuration. Well, and then if that's your only way that you can have forests is if they're empty and wild, then first of all, you have to forget a lot of history. And then you grab it and, you know, it's a sort of nature under glass, if you will. So that what happens is that you set up these national parks that are meant to be some kind of pristine wilderness. And it means that if you want to, it takes away the capacity for people and forests to live together. Now, I happen to be living in Los Angeles, and I live in one of the canyons. And if I look out here, and if I looked at this from a remote sensing thing, I would classify this as a forest. I'm looking out at an oak woodland, live oak woodland, and chaparral. And, you know, it's pretty, it's got people in it and so on. But the point is that you can, even in megalopoli, such as Los Angeles, you can have a lot of wild landscapes, and we have things like bears and pumas and all the wildlife you have. I'm always battling with deer against who are eating my gardens all the time. But so one of the things is that if we're going to go forward into the 21st century in some kind of way, we're going to need forests a lot because they're one of the main things we have for absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. Now, we can wait until there are machines that suck carbon from the atmosphere and spew that carbon back out as diamonds. But as I always like to point out, trees have already been invented. We already have trees. And if we manage trees effectively, they can really do a lot to mitigate climate change. So to get back to the Amazon for just a minute, and I know this is probably swinging wildly around, but let me just bring something up here, which is so I mentioned that there were these large populations that then died, and when they died, those forests came back. Those forests were not just part of Amazonia or Central America, the American tropics. They were part of a global planetary climate system. So one of the theories has it that the little ice age in around 1500 and 1600 in Europe was actually stimulated by the massive amount of carbon that was sucked up as a function of these areas that had been agricultural, that had been open, reverting to forest, and as they reverted to forest, sucking that carbon out of the air and putting it into their little tree bodies as wood and leaves and stuff like that. So one of the things is you can get what are called these teleconnections between events, you know, on planetary systems. Stuff in one place can have a big effect on stuff in other, and particularly that's true of the climate system. So I'm always enthusiastic about forest recovery because, particularly in the tropics and particularly in humid environments, because it allows us to mitigate a lot of this, not as much as you would like, but it's more than you would think. And forests remain a really important climate sink for climate change. So if you imagine a world without forests, we'd be a lot hotter already.
So that's really what I wanted us to get to, and you've started it and gotten us thinking about it. So the program, you know, as I mentioned to you, where are we now? Could you give us a little bit of a balance sheet? Are things okay? Are they pretty bad? What can we look for in the days to come?
I mean, first of all, there really had been progress made on on forests and climate. Part of this was the Paris Accords. Many people in the in the world believe that there's climate change. This is not true of the Trump administration. What you had was movement toward control of greenhouse gases through changing technologies, so moving away from coal and toward more renewable technologies, solar and wind and geothermal and others, reduction of methane through not gassing off a lot of methane in fracking, so a little more regulatory impetus in those areas, because methane is a really powerful greenhouse gas in the short term. Carbon hangs around forever, but methane you can really control. It's a greenhouse gas pollutant, so it's one of these things that you could actually get a handle on if you believed in climate change. And then policies like what's called RED, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation. And essentially what that did is it has many elements to it. There's a lot of politics around it, as you can imagine. But essentially what it involved is financial transfers from various kinds of if you go to a Hyatt hotel, for example, they'll ask you if you want to put a dollar into their carbon fund, so that there were these kind of offset funds where that money would then be applied to various kinds of tropical projects that enhanced local livelihoods as well as forest-based kinds of activities, so that you would keep your forests up. And essentially what it was called paying for environmental services.
Is that carbon trading we're talking about?
Or? Yeah, it's carbon trading, but it's less the trading and more paying for the services.
Okay.
So it's not the financial thing of arbitrage and leveraging carbon markets as what we have here. It's more like offsetting. So you can play around and you can speculate on carbon markets, that you can use carbon as a derivative. So when we talk about carbon trading, we're often talking about a speculative dynamic that's going on within carbon markets. But this is more an offset.
Okay.
And what that means is that you say, I'm going to take an airplane and I'm going to offset my carbon that I'm generating, which has X price, by paying that some amount. And that amount then goes into various kinds of carbon and forest projects that suck carbon out. So there, it's highly imperfect, by the way. Carbon market, it's hard. It's a commons that has been kind of destroyed and used through fossil fuel dynamics, for which we have an important role and part to play. And historically, we're the global culprits, but what it does is it basically provides a mechanism for paying for and supporting carbon uptake projects. And many of those are not giant plantations, but looking at, supporting carbon neutral forms of development or carbon enhancing land uses as opposed to carbon destroying land uses. So there were a number of sort of things that went into place that were, steps forward, even if they were incomplete. I mean, I think we often take the perfect as being what our goal is, and then deriding the steps to get to perfection. But these were at least steps in the right direction. And also these were global initiatives, so everybody pretty much in the world signed on. Now what we have is, and you had a position, a pretty good global position about reducing coal emissions. That's one of the most greenhouse gas intensive activities, and transiting to decarbonizing forms of development. So if you want to think about California, California is one of the world, it's either the fifth or the sixth largest global economy, so it's a big economy, and it emits about 1% of global carbon emissions. So it does reveal that it's possible to really have a dynamic economy that's using a diversity of energy sources in different ways that gives you a lot of economic dynamism without completely trashing the environment. The other thing is, as we know, this is the state that probably has the most rigorous environmental legislation, and somehow, compared to everything else, it's the most dynamic economy in the United States. So it's possible to have environmental regulations, and it's possible to decarbonize the development pathway in order to get a big economy. And I think that we have some empirical proof of that in the dynamics of California.
Hold on here. This is really amazing. I need to pause again, though. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this morning, Cal Winslow. Our program is Where Are We Now? Our guest is Professor, UCLA Professor Susanna Hecht. I mean, I find that extraordinary. 1%? Can you?
Yeah, this comes out of the Berkeley University of California Energy and Resources Group. Also, Janet Napolitano had a group of UC System scholars. What she referred to as the Nifty 50. So it's a loose think tank of climate scholars. I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, before the one of the things she wanted to do was to get the University of California become carbon neutral, so that we would be offsetting or reducing our changing our energy structure so that we would become more carbon neutral by 2020. And then the other thing was, in preparation for the Paris Accords, which now seem like they were in the distant past, so much has gone forward since then, but that was 2015, if you recall. It seems like it was the Pleistocene, since we might as well have gone, since we've gone so far backward. But and so there were sort of 10 interventions for what's called bending the curve. That is, instead of carbon keeping going up exponentially, bending the curve to keep it under 3% or the 3-degree rise in global temperatures. So this was part of her big initiative, and there's, California does have a lot of expertise in both the public and the private sector about carbon management, because this has been an environmental management, because this has been sort of one of the central themes in California's development, is to have air decent, decent landscapes, even as you have a lot of economic growth. So the point being, California is in an interesting state because it's a multi-trillion-dollar economy with very low emissions. And as such, it shows the virtues of regulation, of carbon neutrality, of looking for new forms of energy in ways that permit dynamic economies without, totally hideous environmental consequences. I mean, you can look at the air in Beijing, you can look at the air in Delhi, and essentially we had really shitty air. I don't know if I can say that on the air, but in California, and, you know, there are technologies that were put in place to reduce really terrible air pollution. So the point being that it's possible to have dynamic economies with environmental regulations, and that it may, those have they permit innovation. That is, regulation doesn't just tamp things down. It also is kind of a stimulus to figure out ways to do things so that you don't, so that you can come up with different solutions. So we now have a president, and I'm sure this is not news to any of your listeners, that where the head of the EPA, Mr. Pruitt, is an advocate, as his emails have shown, and collaborator with the energy sector. You have a sort of body of people who are in the environmental ambit that he works in who are climate deniers, including Mr. Pence, his vice president. So we have a sort of what's called atavism, a kind of return to an understanding of climate stuff that is not very helpful. And the arguments that are being advanced, environmental regulations eat up jobs, not really. And an energy policy which is based on fossil fuels, which will be very problematic for the climate. As we know, last year was the hottest year on record. We've been in drought, which also killed about 60 million of our pines of various kinds, along with the instability that climate change caused and the insect outbreaks and so on. So we've had a, I mean, we're reveling in the water right now, but we're seeing a very a lot of climatic instability, and you have a set of people whose policies will only enhance that. And it's a model that argues that the externalities, the problems that come with economic growth, shouldn't be addressed. And also, it's the joke is sort of the big winner of the election were the fossil fuel companies. Mm-hmm. So Rex Tillerson, of course, is not only has he many ExxonMobil has many investments in Russia, but also he's received rewards from the Russian. As like a big chum of Russia, so that's fine, I suppose. But the point is that you have within the in that cabinet basically a coterie of people who are highly linked to fossil fuels. So rather than thinking about becoming a major actor in the realm of alternative fuels and decarbonizing the economy, we have a policy that will enhance the carbon emissions all along. So, countering, basically, China's now trying to decarbonize its system. It puts in several football fields worth of solar panels every hour. So they're decarbonizing, and they are going to be the sort of alternative fuel powerhouse because that's what they're trying to do, whereas we'll be sitting there back emitting like mad, using atavistic technologies, not even trying to reduce the methane emissions that are coming out of all the fracking that we are doing. So it's a very, very unfortunate set of policies, and also one that, in the end, works really against the more innovative parts of the American economy, which actually, of course, began its the alternative fuels, wind fuel, solar panels, et cetera, et cetera. Those were actually, you know, a lot of the innovation in those happened within the United States, and a lot of that within California. So there's some stuff we can do at the level of the state, but within the larger dynamic, I mean, there's the problem is we can be good, but the larger program is one that's extremely destructive.
So we can be good. Should we? I mean, what about, should we be concerned about, say, reforestation up here in the Redwood region or in the Northwest in the Douglas fir forests?
Sure.
Is it too late for that, or does it matter?
It will make it. It all, you know, the thing is, if you think everything is so huge, it can't possibly make a difference. First of all, it's not just climate where it makes a difference. It makes a difference for a number of what we would call environmental services. So it enhances biodiversity and animal habitat, particularly for those mushrooms, you guys. Oh, I love mushrooms. And so, like, right now, I've been picking mushrooms here, you know, chanterelles and stuff, in our mountains here. So, and when I lived up north, I used to, you know, you've got, like, this fungal diversity that is just so gorgeous and so delicious. But anyway, little side note here.
No problem.
It helps your habitat. That's a wet environment. It sucks up a good amount of carbon. You can integrate it into lots of other kinds of activities. There's no, you know, I'm not saying that no tree should ever be cut again, but, you know, there's kind of pointless recovery, pointless deforestation. And the other thing that's important to remember, and I was just up in Northern California, I was just up in Humboldt a couple of months ago. I love my friends there, so I love to go back. And, you know, it was real, and I had looked at the remote sensing in it, and one of the things that you saw was that there really had been a lot of forest recovery, because when people went up there in the 70s to buy this, this was a logged out, fished out, sort of crapped out landscape. It was terrible, and the logging had been Louisiana Pacific just went in, and independent loggers went in, and they just took everything and left this degraded landscape, which is why those hippies could come in and buy in 100 or 200 acres or 50 acres at really nominal costs. Well, one of the things that happened is that, you know, forests came back. The other thing that happened is that the livelihood shifted from being sort of a rough resource-based thing, which you need economies of scale, into an intensive knowledge-based economy, which is the marijuana economy and the wine economy. So those are intensive. They don't use a lot of land, and yet they're very high value. What it means is that kids stay. Everybody I know has their kids there, whereas in lots of other places in the Midwest where I have a lot of family still, those rural areas aren't holding their kids at all. So that's another thing. You know, like what we like is not just sustainability of the landscape, but sustainability of the communities and households and stuff, because people like to have. So the kids would go and get their degrees and their medical degrees and stuff, or not, and then come back and, you know, like to be with their families and be with their friends and be with their communities. That's ripping out of youth in communities is one of the things that's really one of the great tragedies of the Midwestern agro-industrial model of rural development. The other thing that you see that's very interesting, and again, I'm just going to be talking about Humboldt here because that's what I know, is, of course, the rise of their specialized organic producers of things like niche value things, intensive niche value things like goat cheeses, fine, rare kinds of fruits and vegetables and so on. I'm thinking of the goat cheeses because Humboldt Fog, of course, is a niche product that's extremely valuable. It's considered one of the great cheeses of the world, you know. So what you had is what everyone kind of snickered at about having a bunch of goats and suddenly this turns into a different kind of thing. Also, the other thing that you have is the return of growing heirloom wheat just up the road from where I used to live. You now have growing this wonderful heirloom wheat for the region, and organically grown, delicious kinds of things instead of this, you know, on the border of GMO production. And certainly this is carefully land-managed production rather than sort of the extensive kind of thing. So what you've had is you have a kind of a different development model compared to, in contrast to what's being promoted more generally within this administration. And the ag guy is terrible too. The Minister of Agriculture that we have is a nightmare, but which is in that Humboldt region, you have intensive knowledge niche farming for small farmers. And what it's done is it's been able to reproduce the give people a good living, and also has been able to keep those communities intact so that kids can have jobs there, kids can get trained there, the school systems are good or relatively good. So if you want to think about what an alternative rural development might look like, I would say Humboldt County has and parts of Mendocino. I was just looking at the Mendocino numbers. You know, they look better than you would think.
Hmm.
Part of it is, and they're not. That's not even counting the clandestine economy, what we call the clandestine economy, in my universe, which is generating about $500 million a year. So if we start to think about what are dynamic communities, what kinds of dynamic communities are possible there, what you can see is you're getting a lot of value without tearing up the landscape to smithereens.
Well, we're running out of time, Susanna. This is very interesting, but maybe you should just fill us in on your own work. Do you have a new book coming out, something we should be watching for? Or?
Well, first of all, everyone should go and read Scramble for the Amazon.
Okay.
It has this incredible love story in it, and, you know, it's tremendously dramatic and so on, and it also involves a great Brazilian writer, Euclides da Cunha. So, and anyway, and it won the Best Environmental History Award from the American Historical Association for 2015. So there's that. I'm working now on a couple of things. One, I'm working on for how we can use forests, urban forests, agroforests, other kinds of forest systems to enhance carbon absorption. So I'm still like a tree-based kind of gal. The other thing I'm working on is a book on Amazonia, and since the end of communism and the rise of globalization in its modern format. So it's about infrastructure development. So instead of being, you know, save the forest, it's really about the economic transformations in Amazonia as a function both of globalization and environmentalism. So it's about the politics and economics of these. So
okay.
I wish I were done, but
okay.
It goes on for writing is hard. As
yeah. This has really been sensational. Thank you, Susanna.
Okay,
thank you
so much. It's wonderful to be on.
Okay,
call on me whenever you like.
I will. Lots to think about here.
Okay.
This is Cal Winslow. The program this morning has been Where Are We Now? We've been talking to the UCLA professor, Susanna Hecht, and in 2 weeks we'll be back, and speakers to come include Julie Guthman, Michael Watts, and Richard Walker. Good morning.